That's a little bit of a piece by Julius Eastman called Joy Boy, and we're hearing Wild Up performing. We're going to return to that piece and play it in its entirety later on in the program, but it's essentially consisting of a single page. Welcome to Relevant Tones. I'm Seth Bosted. I have a guest on the program today. It is Sam Alvarez, who worked with ACM over the summer, and he has crafted this whole program of pieces where the entire score is on a single page. Sam, welcome to Relevant Tones.
Hey, Seth. Thanks so much for having me today.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much for helping out ACM this summer with Thirsty Ears Festival and everything else that you helped us out with. And of course, for finding all of these really great pieces on the show today.
Yeah, it's been a blast. I love these pieces. So I'm happy to share them.
What is a one-page piece? Can you tell our listeners just what exactly, how does a whole, 10-minute piece fit onto one page?
Yeah, I think that one-page scores is super interesting. Obviously, lots of masterworks are very long. The idea of a massive monumental work of classical music is usually many, many pages, like a whole stack. But a one-page score is obviously any kind of score that's confined to just one page. So in researching for this episode, I came across lots of different things. There's, of course, things like jazz lead sheets, a lot of beginner works, a lot of etudes, even some standard pieces, some piano works naturally are one page. But in the modern and contemporary age, I think there's been a push to explore the possibilities of a page and its singularity beyond these past bounds. So people have started using graphic notation, text-based notation, descriptive notation, guided improv, all sorts of composer-specific improvisational elements to create these very vast, intricate sound worlds that are, I think are super interesting and all come from just one page of notation.
Very cool. And the results, I mean, as we're going to see in the program, can be wildly different from each other.
Yeah, I mean, there's something that's very nice and philosophical about how much can come out of just one blank sheet of paper, but it's all of the possibility in the world. Depends on how a composer uses that one sheet.
And the performers as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of these pieces you'll see, a lot of the creativity and a lot of the resultant sounds depend a lot on how performers interpret a page. So part of the compositional act here is not exactly dictating a sound world or prescribing how something should be played, but rather allowing a set of, or creating a set of instructions that allows a set of performers to create something. So this idea of descriptive notation instead.
Let's start with the first piece by Pauline Oliveros. Tell us about it.
Yeah, when I first started researching this episode, Oliveros was a composer that came to mind. She was a very important American composer, experimental composer, electronic musician in the early days of electronic music, and also just a kind of icon in the world of text-based scores. She has her very famous anthology of text scores has just countless examples of her using one page in all sorts of different creative ways. She has this way of creating prompts for performers, essentially, that asks them to respond to the prompt. It'll be something like, in the example they're about to play, just a single line of something that resembles poetry almost. And she charges performers with interpreting it in a musical sense and responding to their performers around them.
Thank you. That's an excerpt of Noise, a saxophone quartet in Chicago performing live. The piece is called 13 Changes by Pauline Oliveros, and we heard the first several of those changes. This is an example of a one-page score. In this case, is this text, all text that the performers are interpreting. And our guest on the program today is Sam Alvarez, who chose all of the music. Sam, where are we going next?
Yeah, so after exploring that kind of textural realm, that's one approach to a page, I think that another interesting place to go is the realm of graphic scores. And within the entire very vast, broad concept of graphic scores, there's all sorts of different ways to approach it. But essentially what that means at the baseline level is that there is something beyond traditional notation going on, some kind of visual element, some kind of visual manipulation of what's going on the page beyond just notes on staffs. So I thought that it would be natural to break the kind of broad category of graphic scores into a few different smaller subcategories. So I think first off, we can start off with graphic scores that still have elements of traditional notation. And I think a good place to start with that is a piece by George Crumb, this kind of big piano work. It's called 12 Fantasy Pieces After the Zodiac Amplified Piano. And it's this very, very big work. It's kind of monumental. It's part of this entirety called the Macrocosmos, which is a four-volume work of solo piano works. And it alludes to a Bartok piece of a similar name. It's a different set of piano pieces. And all of the works of this four-volume piece have many parts, and these many parts have several movements. But what connects all of them is that throughout the parts, throughout all the different volumes, each of the final movements has a graphic score of some sort. So we're going to play two of them today. We're going to play a movement that's called the Magic Circle of Infinity, in parentheses, Moto Perpetuo, and a different movement called Agnus Dei. And both of these have something graphic going on. The first one we'll play, the Magic Circle of Infinity, consists of a single staff that is twisted into a circle on the page. And within the single circle on the page, there is one line in between that acts as a kind of prelude. So Crumb tasks the performer to read the line within the circle and then navigate around the circle of notes, essentially, that it, you know, of course starts right side up, but then it's upside down, which poses all sorts of reading difficulties, and then circles all the way around. And this is kind of a painting of what's going on musically. Marked in the score, he writes, like cosmic clockwork with mechanically precise rhythm as the performer slowly works around the circle. And it kind of factors into this idea of moto perpetuo, perpetual motion, which is kind of a common idea in all sorts of piano works. But here, Crumb paints it not only musically, but also literally on the single page of the score.
I want to say for our listeners, too, if you're listening on Spotify or Apple and you want to see these scores, go to relevanttones.com because I'll post all of the scores. You should really see what these look like if you're curious. And of course, we can't do that with our podcast players, but I can do it on our website. And here are the two pieces Sam mentioned by George Crumb.
Thank you.
what he does with the performer, you know, I mean, I think, you know, because there's so many composers now who are thinking about the fact that the performer is a human being who can clap and yell and dance and do all these things. But Crumb was there well ahead of most people in that regard.
Yeah, as I think a great example of that is in the second movement here, he's actually asking the pianist to sing along with their own playing. Agnus Dei is Lamb of God. It's kind of a hymn used for peace usually. And of course, the hymn is usually sung, so Crumb just goes ahead and notates a song voice along with the piano playing, having the pianist sing along with their own playing in a kind of interesting extended technique.
And again, these scores are just beautiful. I mean, Crumb, you know, could have been a very successful draftsman as well as a composer because they're gorgeous.
Yeah, there's some stories about how kind of maniacally he engraved these scores. The second one, Agnus Dei, the score is kind of manipulated and wrapped into a peace sign. There's a circle of one staff wraps around, one staff cuts through, there's two connecting into a kind of stereotypical peace sign. And I read this interesting story about how in the engraving process he was incredibly anal about it and very exacting. He wanted it to be exactly perfect. It's like a work of art kind of on its own, just looking at it. And also with the connotations of the hymn that the peace sign is based on and the kind of upsetting, grating sound world that he assigns to it. There's, I think, a lot of interesting interaction with the, you know, either the Vietnam War, whatever's happening socially in the climate at the time. There's a lot of interplay, it seems like.
Definitely. Well, I knew the first two pieces you brought in. I don't know where we're going now. Tell us about where are we going now?
Yeah, so we're going to stay within the realm of graphic scores for a couple more pieces, but we're going to jump into a much more recent piece. This next one is by a composer named Brittany J. Green, and she's a North Carolina-based composer and performer. And she's really rising in the new music world. Her works are getting a lot of play these days. And she, I think, does a really interesting job of maybe in a kind of contemporary version of what we were just talking about for Crumb, of interacting with the social environment of the current contemporary world. And I think this piece is a really nice interpretation and showing of that. Like I was talking about earlier, it's still in the graphic score realm, but this one is just a little bit more abstract than what we were talking about before. I kind of call this a semi-abstract graphic score. The piece we're going to play is a piece called Intersections by Brittany J. Green. And it still kind of has staff. It still kind of has staves on it. It still kind of has notes, but not quite. The score, like I said, of course, is just one page, but it has staffs that wrap around and form into a kind of cross on the page. So some wrap up and down, and then two more wrap across, forming a kind of flower in the middle of the page. And similar to the last piece, she asked the performer to read along the shape. So sometimes they're reading upside down, sometimes they're reading up and down. But very rarely just a cross like you would in a traditional piece. And unlike traditional notation, the note heads that she writes on these twisting staves, they don't really fall onto any particular pitch. She describes in the program notes that she's more interested in players reading like intervals and direction of lines rather than exact pitch content. She welcomes performers to kind of play what pitches they think are right, different transpositions, different timbres, different speeds. And she's interested in exploring how taking a similar line as far as arranging note heads can go and transposing it into different contexts, either by like flipping it upside down, by putting it on a different part of this flower-shaped score so that it's read in a different way, or what it's simply being read by a different performer, how all these different contexts affect the sonic experience. So in this performance we're going to listen to, it's important to think about that a lot of this is being figured out on the spot. Green recommends actually that the performers don't share their starting place with each other, and that nonverbal communication is used to signal any kind of expressive moments in the piece, but also the ending. And maybe just before we played, I'll read the very brief program note she shares first, which is, Intersections is a concept piece representative of the finite yet infinite nature of moments where paths are crossed. The piece has no set beginning or ending, just a cycle of intersected lines to be interpreted at the performer's will. So with that, maybe here's Brittany J. Greene's Intersections.
That's an interpretation of the piece by Brittany J. Green called Intersections. And we heard Sam Alvarez, our guest on Relevant Tones today, talking about how the piece is structured. This is an example of what he's calling a semi-abstract graphic score. We're featuring one-page pieces on the program today, and we're going to move next to a fully abstract graphic score. So Sam, how are you defining that?
Yeah, so I'm essentially defining that as something with little to no traditional notational elements. This could go as far as something that is like a painting on a page that a composer tasks musicians to interpret musically, or it can be something like what we're about to explore that has the slightest glimmer of traditional notation, but the way that it functions is really through these shapes and arrows and instructions written on the page. There's very little in this piece that resembles what we traditionally think of in a notated score.
Yeah, and again, to our listeners, if you want to check these out, go to relevanttones.com. And so this is Luis Fernando Amaya's piece, La mano izquierda es la que escribe las mentiras chiquitas.
I think we're going to now take a little bit of a departure from graphic scores, one approach to the single page, and talk about something that I wasn't exactly sure how to describe, but I've essentially come to refer to as a guiding framework. This kind of refers to the idea of composers using a single page as a space to offer a framework or performance to a composer, to a performer. So we have two examples of this ready to go. And the first one is by the growing in popularity composer and obviously very important current figure, Julius Eastman, the late New York-based experimental and avant-garde composer. For those of you familiar to Eastman's work, he wrote a lot in the 60s and 70s. He died in the 80s. He lived a very complex life. He lived his life as a Black queer man in the avant-garde music scene in New York, and his relationships with other composers were very complicated. He, in some ways, was pushed to the margins of the music scene because of his Blackness, because of his queerness. But he also kind of took an agented stance in his own distancing from that world. And his progression from kind of celebrated composer and performer into poverty at the end of his life and his untimely death, very young, in the mid-80s, is a very complicated story, but one that is full of a lot of really meaningful art that is now kind of being celebrated. And this is a great example of that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, perhaps the most famous one-page score of all is In C by Terry Riley. So there's a million different ways you could have gone with finding recordings of this. I mean, everybody has you know, almost everybody has recorded In C, it feels like. So what's the recording you chose, Sam?
I chose good old Terry Riley's original recording from 1968. I think that finding the best expression of this piece that's now, of course, risen to kind of household name status. I think going back to the very beginning is a nice way to listen to it. Released as a single in 1968 in its full 40-minute almost entirety, I think that it's a pretty monumental recording and it's a really nice example of how this piece goes.
Very nice. All right. Well, we will listen to as much as we have time for, but this is the original recording of In C by Terry Riley. Sam, thank you so much for choosing this amazing program.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me today. It's nice to share some music and some saxophone music with the world.
Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of bringing musical creativity to life every day. Find out more at acmusic.org. On behalf of Relevant Tones, I'm Seth Bosted. Thanks so much for listening.